This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:07 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod. First up, we're always starting with story number 5, a mini pulpit parliament where we bring you some highlights from the day one right yet.
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. The government is looking at 3 emergent technologies to improve internet services nationwide. Now, this is according to Communications Minister Fahmi Fazil. These include direct-to-device connectivity, low-Earth orbit satellites like Starlink, and fixed wireless broadband, which all aims to boost internet access in rural areas.
Sukacita saya sebut juga ada beberapa teknologi baru ataupun baru muncul ataupun dengan izin, emergent technologies yang sedang diteliti oleh pihak MCMC melalui dengan izin proof of concept. Ini termasuklah penggunaan satelit LEO, low earth orbit satellites seperti Starlink untuk menyediakan backhaul kepada menara-menara di beberapa lokasi di seluruh negara. Kedua adalah penggunaan fixed wireless broadband untuk membantu dari segi backhaul bagi menara-menara yang mungkin sedikit jauh daripada kawasan yang mempunyai gentian optik. Ketiga adalah teknologi yang agak menarik dan belum lagi digunakan, tapi ianya dinamakan direct to cell ataupun direct to device. Ini sangat bersesuaian kerana ia bermakna kita tidak bergantung harap kepada menara-menara untuk memancarkan signal, tetapi kita boleh menggunakan phone kita untuk berkomunikasi terus dengan satelit, dan itulah satelit itulah yang seolah-olah menjadi menara. Ini teknologi baru yang mungkin akan dilaksana sekitar 2025. Dan akhir sekali, kita juga memanfaatkan teknologi seperti Starlink untuk menggunapakai teknologi ataupun kemudahan mesh Wi-Fi yang dapat meningkatkan dengan izin the range of the technology. Sekian. Terima kasih.
That was Communications Minister Fahmi Fadil. Moving on, the Deputy Minister of Domestic Trade and Cost of Living, Fuzia Saleh, said that the distribution of essential goods, such as sugar, packed oil and local rice, is more stable than it was pre-GE15.
Now, this was in response to Masjid Tana MP Dato' Wira Mas Emiyati Shamsuddin, who implied that the current distribution of essential goods was unstable. The somewhat tense exchange prompted Speaker Tan Sri Johari Abdul to step in.
Terima kasih Yang Berhormat. Tapi kan saya kena jawab juga apa Yang Berhormat nak cakap. Yang Berhormat lupa ke sebelum PRU15, telur langsung tak ada dalam pasaran. Sebelum PRU15
tu.
Ya, Yang Berhormat. Ya,
13, 14, dalam soalan Yang Berhormat. Jawab je lah soalan. Tak payahlah nak
bayar telur tak ada
dalam Dewan. Yang Berhormat.
Sebelum pagi raya, Yang Berhormat.
Miss Jek Tanah. Bukan cara dia macam ni.
Miss Jek Tanah. Saya tahu. Saya tahu Yang Berhormat Speaker. Saya tahu.
Dia ada jawab dulu. Kalau tahu. Saya jawab, baru bagi.
Baik, terima kasih.
Okay. Sebab tu saya kata, Yang Berhormat Majlis Tanah kena ingat Oktober tahun 2022, telur langsung tak ada dalam pasaran. Minyak 5 kilo waktu sebelum PRU RM35. Sekarang 5 kilo RM25. Yang Berhormat cakap pasal, kena bercakap berfakta.
So, Mas Ermiati had also asked whether wheat flour subsidies worth 40 million ringgit had been discontinued, to which the Deputy Minister explained that the subsidy hasn't stopped, but was moved to the Payung Rahma programme under Budget 2023. She also noted that the original subsidy had not been claimed as there was little consumer demand for all-purpose flour.
Berkenaan dengan tepung, Tan Sri Tua, beri saya peluang untuk menjawab. Pada Budget 2023, ada butiran 040600, iaitu subsidi tepung gandum kegunaan am RM40 juta. Pada budget 2024, butiran ini tiada. Ya, dan ditanya dalam dewan ini daripada ahli Yang Berhormat, sebab tu saya menggulung peringkat jawatankuasa. Check handset sebab saya ada jawab. 40, saya ingat Rasah yang bertanya.
Ya, betul.
40 juta itu ada tetapi di bawah butiran Payung Rahmah. 200 juta Payung Rahmah itu termasuk 40 juta untuk tepung. Itu apa orang kata ulasan daripada MOF. Ya. Dan saya nak beritahu Tan Sri Tua, tepung kegunaan am ni, 40 juta ni, bajet tu ada kita asingkan tapi tak pernah dituntut. Dah beberapa tahun tak pernah dituntut Yang Berhormat Tan Sri Tua. Kerana apa? Kerana tak ada kilang yang nak buat tepung kegunaan am ni. Ya, jadi dan rakyat pun tak pernah minta tepung gundaan alam dan tak ada kilang yang nak buat. Yang keluar ke tepung cap kunci, tepung cap ros, tak ada tepung kegunaan alam ini, tak ada kilang yang buat. Tak sedia pun. Itu saya nak maklumkan. Terima kasih.
That was Deputy Minister of Domestic Trade and Costs of Living, Fuzia Saleh. For our final story, the Deputy Defence Minister, Adli Zahari, has announced that National Service 3.0 is set to enlist secondary school and university level students, as well as youth who are not enrolled in higher education. This comes as the ministry is finalising the program's core curriculum and training modules.
Rangka PLKN kita seperti mana yang kita rancang. Sebenarnya buat masa ini kita sedang memuktamadkan libat urus kita dan juga modul sama ada dari segi core curriculum dia dan begitulah juga dengan beberapa modul-modul latihan. Dan kalau kita melihat seperti mana yang disebut, dia melibatkan pelajar kita di peringkat sekolah menengah dan juga kalau kita lihat di peringkat universiti juga. Sebab itu kadang-kadang kalau kita lihat ada di kalangan pelajar-pelajar kita yang tidak memasuki universiti itu, mereka itu kita gulungkan di kalangan mereka yang belia yang terlibat dengan PLKN ini. Itu sebab kalau kita lihat kepada modul-modul kita ini dan saya fikir bila kita muktamadkan nanti latihan-latihan ini bukan sahaja melibatkan pelajar di peringkat menengah itu dan dia juga melibatkan pelajar-pelajar yang memasuki universiti maupun tidak memasuki universiti itu. Sebab itu kalau kita lihat kita ada tempoh masa dan tempoh tahap umurnya bagi memastikan bahawa program ini dapat kita laksanakan sebaik mungkin.
That was Deputy Defence Minister Adli Zahari on the government's proposal to enlist secondary school and university level students, as well as youth who aren't enrolled in higher education. We'd like to hear from you. I mean, if you were eligible, would you enlist in the military? That number to call, 7733-2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp, 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. And that is it for today's parliamentary updates and therefore also Story 5. Stay tuned for story number 4 on Top 5 at 5 coming up right after this, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
It is 5:16 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod. Earlier, it was our mini coverage of Parliament and it's time now for story number 4, which was the terrorist attack that took place near Moscow.
Now, this tragic attack took place on Friday at the Crocus City Hall, where four armed men burst into and fired upon some 6,000 people who were attending a rock concert there. Now, the attackers also set fire to the hall, which caused the roof to collapse. This attack has been described as Russia's worst terrorist attack in decades, with 137 deaths and 182 people injured.
So ISIS Khorasan, which is, of course, the Afghan-based militant group claimed responsibility for the attack within hours and released graphic footage of the attackers filming themselves firing on the crowd. However, Russian officials have suggested that there may have been Ukrainian involvement, although Zelensky has rejected these claims.
Now, false suspects have been arrested in connection with the attack, and the court said that all four of them will be held in a pre-trial detention until at least the 22nd of May.
So we reached out to Julia Rocknifad from the School of Politics, History and International Relations at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, to talk about why Russia was targeted.
Purpose-wise, why ISIS Khorasan would actually decide to administer an attack against Russia, we can speculate a little bit. We know that Russia participated in a campaign to support Syria and Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad. Therefore fighting against ISIS over there. Russia also maintains friendly relationship with the Taliban government in Afghanistan, and ISIS Khorasan is the Afghanistan branch. A couple of years ago, there was an attack by the same branch against the Russian embassy in Kabul, and this is this was seen rather because Russia did not evacuate its embassy after Taliban came to power, and ISIS Khorasan sees Taliban government as its direct adversary. So Russia that refused to evacuate the embassy was seen as a part of the collective West. So it was attacked as a collective West target rather than Russia per se. But also for its participation in the overall campaign of fighting ISIS as a whole. So I think there are enough reasons for ISIS to be unhappy with decisions of the Russian government and choose it as a target, potentially, if we assume that the attack indeed was perpetrated by ISIS Khorasan.
That was Julia Rognefeld from the School of Politics, History and International Relations at Nottingham University, Malaysia. Just a quick note that this week, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, Andrei Rudenko, will be here on an official visit. He'll also be speaking on Russia's policy in the Asia-Pacific at the Asia-Europe Institute at University of Malaya this Friday afternoon.
Of course, if you have thoughts that you'd like to share, you can call 7733-2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. In the meantime, we're bringing it back home to Malaysia. Story number three, the fate of the Vivekananda ashram hangs in the balance.
Yeah, and yet again. So recently, the unveiled draft Kuala Lumpur local plan 2040 was revealed, and what it revealed, in fact, was that the plot on which the historic Vivekananda ashram stands has lost its heritage status. Currently, the draft describes the location as a major commercial area.
So this has understandably sparked concerns that interested parties are going to look to redevelop the land, thus putting the 124-year-old ashram in jeopardy. Now, I think it's important to say that this is not the first time that alarms have been raised or that concerns have come up regarding this. In 2014, the ashram's board of trustees approved the sale of the plot of land to developers who at the time wanted to build a residential tower there.
Now, following the news of that decision and public protest, the then Tourism and Culture Minister, that's Sri Mohammad Nazri Abdul Aziz, decided to act. And the ashram was finally gazetted as a heritage building in 2016.
So in reports, Dato' M. Ali, who's the chairman of Save Kuala Lumpur, had expressed disappointment at this recent turn of events. And we reached out to him for further comment.
Well, I refer to the historic ashram, which is the Vivekananda ashram, which is again in jeopardy and again back on the news. It is shocking and disappointing to observe that DBKL has thought of converting the whole area into a major commercial area. And again, here again, we go back to the consultants, is by sharing with them that they should not look at just development for the sake of the developers, but for the people's interests as well as historical value, sentimental. And all those social impact has got to be looked into in depth. And a lot of people are already upset and they're all already making moves. We are critical of the planners, the consultant, because the consultant, we should have highlighted this. This is totally irregular and they should not have agreed or recommended such a proposal, even if DBKL has thought about it. This is purely trying to legalize what is totally illegal. Therefore, the enforcement has come in and appropriate action should be taken and there should be no change to accommodate one or two individuals by trying to manipulate the draft plan.
That was Dato' M. Ali, chairman of Save Kuala Lumpur, talking about how the Kuala Lumpur Local Plan 2040 intersects with worries around the Vivekananda ashram losing its heritage status. And I think for people who don't know where it is, perhaps it's useful to talk about where exactly it's located, because I think that might help to paint a picture about why it is that these questions of development keep coming up, because it's in really a very central location.
Yeah, indeed. It's a kind of an oasis of calm in, you know, very busy brick fields. If you can imagine, it's kind of diagonally across from Central, that hub that's, you know, highly developed and full of high rises. And it sits on the low rise end of brick fields where, you know, when you're starting to go into the food and the shops and, you know, and the clothing and the fashion, all that, that is the hub, right? So perhaps if you remember that fountain feature that, you know, was, I think, developed when the president of India came many, many years ago, all that is where kind of Vivekananda stands. And because, you know, because of its age, I think, and it's actually a very beautiful building. Lynn, have you ever visited
I haven't visited. I've passed it many times. And I think that every time I do, and I remember the story from 2014, I'm struck once more by our drive to develop everything that can possibly be developed in Kuala Lumpur. I mean, I think that the commercial considerations behind it are considerable and understandable because of the location, because of the fact that we can't seem to stop attempting to build high rises, because we can't seem to stop trying to get commercial centers going or expanding. But in some ways, it's a very classic story, right? The question of what we value in a city and what we want to keep.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that maybe planners don't recognize is that, you know, to make a city interesting, especially if you think of the tourism potential of a Kuala Lumpur, something of the past has to be preserved, because that's what people come to see. They don't come to see a city that looks just like their city, that looks like any mall that is, you know, has been developed across the globe. And, you know, the homogeneity of urban design is not what they're looking to experience more of. They're trying to experience something that is different, right? And so what is lovely about Brickfields, and I lived there for a couple of years, is it's kind of religious spaces and all this interesting, vibrant life that's around it. And the ashram is a counterpoint to that. And so it would be, I think, really a loss to the city if, in fact, it is bulldozed.
So talk to us. I mean, this is in relation to the historic Vivekananda Ashram losing its heritage status per the draft Kuala Lumpur Plan 2040. What do you think? How can we do better for our heritage sites, especially when there is this big commercial imperative? You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad. So far, we've talked about what happened in Parliament today, as well as a terrorist attack in Russia, and the Vivekananda Ashram once more having its heritage status kind of upended slightly. And now for story number two. The police have opened a sexual harassment investigation involving a secondary school student and a female teacher.
Right. So the story began last year in December when the 16-year-old arrived home from school with love bites on his neck. He told his mother that the marks were made by his math teacher.
So the student's mother lodged a police report that very same day, and the teacher was transferred to another school, but the relationship continued. Eventually, the student's sister posted about it on X. Those posts have been taken down, but it didn't stop the story from going viral.
Now, according to Sepang District Police Officer Assistant Commissioner Wan Kamarul Azran Wan Yusuf, the case is being probed under Section 14 of the Sexual Offences Against Children Act. In addition, the Ministry of Education released a statement condemning the conduct of the teacher and promised to cooperate with the investigation.
The ministry did continue by saying that all educational institutions are requested to comply with the sexual misconduct management guidelines that are currently enforced to preserve the safety and well-being of students. So, to understand this better, we reached out to Ajit Kaur, lawyer and co-chairperson of CRIP Foundation.
Based on reporting that I have read, the police are investigating the teacher under Section 14 of the Sexual Offences Against Children Act, which basically covers physical sexual assault on a child. What's important to highlight is the Sexual Offences Against Children Act, or the SOAC, was recently amended to cover situations of children who have been groomed under the age of 18. So in effect, if the facts as published are true, this will also be a classic case of sexual grooming, which would come under Section 12. And as the teacher is in a position of trust, what is important to highlight is that based on the SOAC Section 16, any person in a relationship of trust, if found guilty, would have their sentence enhanced by another 5 years, as well as whipping. Recently, there was a convention on the issue of protection of children from sexual exploitation held on the 16th of March, where the Minister of Education had come out and clearly stated that there is zero tolerance when it comes to allegations of sexual misconduct of children. What's important to highlight is that it's very, very crucial that not only should children be educated on their rights and also about personal safety, but teachers as well have to attend courses and trainings on the do's and the don'ts, because this allegation crosses the border of professional conduct, where children are entrusted to the school during school hours, and the safety and the protection of the children is extremely important.
That was lawyer and co-chairperson of CRIP Foundation, Ajit Kaur. And that was, of course, a response to the fact that there has been a sexual harassment investigation that has been opened up by the police involving a 16-year-old secondary school student and a female math teacher. And I think the story is troubling for so many reasons. I mean, it goes without saying that it's wrong on multiple levels. I think that Ajit's points actually cover a fair amount of them. The fact that the teacher is in a position of trust and power, the fact that there is this age discrepancy, I think just the more you read about the story, actually, the more troubling it is.
Yeah, I think the law is very clear. Whatever the specificities of the individuals involved, I mean, boys mature at varying levels. A 16-year-old can be quite sexually mature, but they're not necessarily emotionally mature. But that doesn't give anybody the right, least of all a teacher, as you say, in a position of trust, to exploit that or to use that. So, maybe in the minds of the individuals involved, it was all voluntary and welcomed, but that's beside the point, right? We have our laws that generally have to kind of draw a line at some point, and in Malaysia at least, and for now, we've drawn that line at 18, and so this is, whatever you might say about this, the specifics of the case, this is just beyond the pale.
So if you'd like to weigh in on this, you know the numbers. You can call 7733-2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Top 5 at 5. Stay tuned for story number one, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
It is 5:43 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad. It is time for story number one. McDonald's Malaysia has withdrawn its defamation suit against BDS Malaysia.
Yeah, and I think that's been kind of a real interesting twist in the story that's gone on for some time with many positions stake. But it also came with an interesting, statement from BDS Malaysia that I personally was uncertain about, right? So I talked to many people and, Lynn, and asked them, what exactly do you think this statement means? And I think that in many ways is something we tried to clear up with our interview today.
Yes, because the statement involves the acknowledgement that the operator here in Malaysia is wholly independent and not linked to the one in Israel. But they did say that McDonald's will remain categorized under the organic boycott target. So I think what this means, what it's going to play out as, remains to be seen. I just did want to say that we also reached out to McDonald's Malaysia, but they asked us to refer to their existing statement made on Friday and said that they're not going to comment beyond that. So if you'd like to weigh in again, what do you make of this development in the McDonald's versus BDS situation? You can call, you can send us a voice note or WhatsApp, you can tweet us as well. Speaking with us now, we have Muhammad Nazari Ismail, chairperson of the BDS Movement Malaysia. Nazari, thanks for speaking with us. Now, according to media reports, McDonald's Malaysia has withdrawn its defamation suit against BDS following the, and I quote, positive outcome of the mediation between the two of you. What was your initial reaction to this?
Now, what happened was there was a mediation that took place, as you know. But at the end of the first mediation session, there was no agreement, actually. There was no agreement. That was the reason why we had to go for a second mediation session on the 30th of April. So that was the arrangement. So we were waiting for to meet again. We were looking forward to meet again on the 30th of April to try to resolve our differences. And then suddenly, out of the blue, I was informed by my lawyer that Gerbang Alaf, the plaintiff, decided to withdraw the case. So I was actually, to be honest with you, quite surprised, because we were not, in a way, we were expecting that to happen, but at the same time, we were not expecting it to happen so soon. We thought that they may do that after the second mediation session. Okay, their case is not very strong, so we knew that they may change their mind. But we were actually expecting to have a second mediation, because we thought that they would want to to try to resolve the differences in opinion about the case.
Now, your organization's recent statement said that McDonald's Malaysia will continue to be categorized under the organic boycott target due to its alleged complicity with Israeli actions in Palestine. Can you give us some clarification on what your position is on this matter?
Okay. If you look back at the case, when the Malaysian public decided to boycott McDonald's, when the some Malaysians were boycotting McDonald's before that, but the boycott by the Malaysian public increased after October 7. So at that point in time, McDonald's was not on the list of targets by BDS Malaysia. Okay, but what happened was, McDi in Israel gave free food to Israeli soldiers. As you know, right? They gave free food. And some other restaurant chains also gave free food to Israeli soldiers. Now, because of that, the global BDS movement decided that there is justification for the Malaysian, for the public all over the world to boycott McDi, because the actions of any franchisee cannot take place without the permission of or the agreement of the main McDi Corporation. So McDi Corporation is responsible for the actions of the franchisees in Israel. So because of that, there is justification for the public to boycott McDi. So that's why we categorize it as organic boycott. In other words, boycott initiated by the public, which we recognize it has justification. We did not initiate the boycott. It was initiated by the public. And we recognize that, meaning there is justification for that.
So could you help us understand how BDS performs background checks on businesses and how they verify the link between McDonald's Malaysia, which is a franchisee, to Israel?
Okay. To answer that question, I want to highlight the consumer targets first, the targeted one, not the organic boycott, huh? The targeted companies such as HP or Caltex. Now, Caltex, for example, by Chevron, American company. And Chevron is extracting oil in Eastern Mediterranean Sea near Palestine. So that money, the revenue from that actually belongs to the Palestinians. But now that billions of dollars are going to be given to Israel when actually they belong to Palestinians. They are going to help to perpetuate the apartheid crimes and genocide crimes of Israel towards the Palestinians. So Chevron is complicit because of their collaboration with the Israeli government to extract oil from the Eastern Mediterranean near Palestine. And Chevron, together in collaboration with Israel, it's actually public knowledge, which you don't have to, it actually announced by them. We don't have to do much research on that. Similarly, in the case of HP, they actually collaborated with Israel. But then later on, HP changed its name, the company that are operating in Israel, they changed their name. So we had to rely on research. And we have people who do research based in Israel who will find out the contracts, any collaboration between HP and the Israeli government. In the case of McDonald's, their complicity was just now through the announcement of McDonald's in Israel, where they said that they were giving free food to Israeli military. So we didn't have to do much research. It was announced in the public, right? McDonald's is responsible for its franchises all over the world. So therefore, they are complicit. They are complicit. The whole McDonald's is actually complicit because the actions of franchisees.
Now, your group has always maintained that the defamation suit was without merit or lacked legal foundation. What was the group's reasoning for this?
Let me explain now. We go back. After the Israeli, the franchisee, McDonald's franchisee in Israel gave free food, we actually wrote an open letter advising McDonald's Malaysia, Gerbang Alaf, to issue a statement to disassociate themselves, to distance themselves from the actions of the franchisee in Israel. Because if they did not do that, the Malaysian public will feel upset because the logo is the same, the name is the same, right? The logo is the same, the name is the same. There's only one McDonald's. There's no separate logo and name for McDonald's in Israel and separate one for McDonald's in Malaysia. It's the same. So that's the reason why consumers decide to boycott McDonald's, because they see as being in the same organization. So our advice in an open letter issued in November 7, before receiving the official legal suit, we advise them to issue a statement to condemn Israeli crime, to condemn the genocide being committed by Israel, and also to condemn the action of the franchisee in Israel to give free food to the Israeli military. But as you know, Gerbang Alaf never issued any statement to condemn the genocide committed by Israel in Gaza. They gave some donation to Micah, some other organizations for the Palestinian, but they did not issue a statement to condemn Israeli crimes. So during the mediation, let me share with you that we said to them again, we suggested to them again that if you want the Malaysian public to have a positive perception towards you, and for us to consider taking you out, the McDonald's logo, sorry, yeah, to take the McDonald's logo out of the organic boycott category, you should issue a statement to condemn Israeli crimes, which they refused. And that was the reason why we couldn't come to an agreement at the end of the first session of the mediation. So we were hoping that we can convince them again during the second session on the 30th of April to convince them that it would be good for them if they can issue a statement to condemn Israeli crimes. But that didn't happen. Instead, they withdrew the suit. So your question was, do we think that they have got a strong case against us? They don't have a strong case against us because we never mentioned that McDonald's Malaysia was responsible for the crimes against the Palestinian people, for crime of genocide. We didn't say that. We never said that. There is no ground for suing us.
So having said that, there have been several reports of present and former employees of McDonald's and Starbucks, actually, calling for an end to the boycott, saying that their livelihoods have been severely impacted. How do you consider these sorts of ramifications on employees and on people?
This is the responsibility of the management of McDonald's and also Gerbang Alaf. They are responsible. If they want the consumers to start coming back to their restaurants, they should make sure that what they do is in line with the values of the consumers. The consumers are upset because they see that their perception is that McDonald's is complicit because of the action of the franchisee in Israel. Now, if Gerbang Alaf issue a statement to say that we condemn the action of the franchisee in Israel for giving free food to the Israeli military so that they can continue to keep Palestinians, and if they say that we condemn the Israeli crime of genocide against the Palestinian people, which was also agreed by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, then if they do that, I'm sure the Malaysian public will have a better perception of McDonald's. And so the trouble that they are going through and the losses among the workers, that is you have to put the blame on the management of McDonald's Corporation as well as the management of the franchisees. You can't blame the consumers and don't blame us also. And the origin or the source of the problem is actually the crime of atrocities, the crime of apartheid and genocide in Palestine. So if they condemn that and if they really contribute towards efforts to stop those crimes, I am sure the public will not have a negative perception towards McDonald's and other restaurants and other companies that are complicit, and it'll be back to a normal situation again.
Nasri, do you have final thoughts for us?
You know, we know what is happening in Palestine. It's actually real-time news now, right? We know, for example, now at this very moment, the Israelis are still killing Palestinians, including women and children, including also those who were queuing for food. They are starving people and queuing for food, and they will be killed. And Israel continues to do that, has no intention to change their actions. That they are moving forward with the support of the Americans. So what the world community, everybody around the world should do is to figure out how to stop this genocide from continuing, how to stop the crimes that are being committed towards the Palestinian people. That should be the most important consideration rather than about profit.
Nazari, thanks for speaking with us. That was Muhammad Nazari Ismail, chairperson of the BDS Movement Malaysia, commenting on the fact that McDonald's Malaysia has withdrawn their defamation suit against BDS. We are asking you for your thoughts. We've also actually been asking you for what you think about all five of our stories today, and we've got some thoughts that have come in. Let's start with this one on the Vivekananda Ashram, which we spoke about earlier, because per a draft version of the KL Plan 2040, it is losing its heritage status, which has once more raised alarms about the possibility of it being developed. And Anon says, I sometimes wonder who is sitting in City Hall. Are they KLites or Selangorians? What history or heritage can the future generations relate to when we keep giving way to commercialization? We're fast losing our identity, not through the quote-unquote invasion of foreign migrants, but avaricious capitalists and local migrants.
Anon, you know, you asked some very interesting questions about who's represented at DBKL in drafting and designing these plans for the future. And you're right. I mean, what are their values, especially when you see something as wonderful and historic as the Vivekananda Ashram now, you know, basically laid naked to any kind of rapacious actions by a developer who just wants a high rise there and maximize profits.
You know, but the other point that's being raised is one of identity, right? And that's also interesting, because I think that I could imagine that some people see KL's identity as one of high rises, as one of modernity. And so I think when we talk about city identity, it's quite an interesting conversation, because I don't know if there is a collective agreement that heritage matters.
That's true. I mean, there might not be that consensus, right? But if, Lynn, in terms of like brickfields, or if you just look right across, you stood in front of the ashram and you looked across the street, it's all high rise. And yeah, and I think anybody who travels to KLIA and, you know, wants that kind of strategic location for where they live in the city, it's already there. So why not preserve this little that remains of this place? I mean, even the name Brickfields is kind of evocative of a long history of development of the city.
Let us know if you have any thoughts, and do keep it here, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.